The following Noble Path talk is part of an informal series offered to Sangha members for those who've been practicing at the Zen Center of New York City, Fire Lotus Temple. Each Sangha member shares their experience of how they came to find the Dharma and how their practice has been developing. We hope you enjoy the diversity of voices and experiences. Thank you for listening.
Okay, good morning. So good morning, everyone. Thank you, Joshin, for that introduction. Yeah. When Hojin Sensei offered, well, to come and do that retreat yesterday, she said, oh, you might like to do a Noble Path talk too. And I don't think you say no to that. So, yeah. And I was like, well, you know, a couple years ago, I did the sort of, this is how I came to Zen talk. And I said, so what should I say? And she said, well, you've been around for a while. Why, you know, how have you stuck with it? So, if I had to give a title to my talk, I would call it Making It My Own. And I just want to clarify first that when I say like my own or my practice or own it, I don't mean own in a kind of, you know, tight scarcity mindset way. I mean own it in the sense of, you know, yesterday we were talking about that experiential confidence, that kind of very open-handed, confident, generous way when you own something and you can be therefore quite generous and feel spacious with it. So just to be clear, that's what I mean. yeah, so when I look back on my years of practice and training, one way I think about it is just this ever-deepening understanding of how to own my practice. You know, having been given the same instructions that if you came today for the first time, you received upstairs. That's where I received my first instruction, beginning instruction. And I'm guessing it's pretty much the same as what was offered today, because it's instruction that's centuries old. So, you know, how do we own something like that? You know, how do we enter that? But the more that I have allowed that to be a possibility and kind of explored what does that mean, the practice just gets deeper, broader, and more light and easeful. But it's been a challenge for me. It's been a challenge. And certainly part of what's challenging is that in the beginning, it's kind of overwhelming. Like perhaps today for you, I walked in the door not knowing what to expect. And right away, we're bowing, we're chanting. There's people in robes offering incense. There's bells. Like, what is going on, right? And like, again, like, how do you enter something that for me was so new and unfamiliar and then really own it? You know, I reflect, as Joshin said, I'm a yoga teacher, yoga therapist, and yoga has so many tools. So there's so many ways you can enter in and experience yoga. And then, you know, slowly build towards self-reflection and a deeper kind of inquiry. But here, you kind of just get tossed into the deep end. Everyone gets the same instructions. And, like, what is that? Is it one size fits all? There's a Sanskrit word, shikshana, and it means learning or growth. And it's a word that we use in yoga to describe a kind of practice that's intended to stir things up, like intentionally create friction. It's friction, but it's a good friction. And it's created to generate opportunities for self-knowledge and insight. And I think about Zen practice, Zazen, as a kind of shikshana practice. It's just so sparse and kind of impersonal, but it's part of making it a kind of intentional friction. So I want to share a couple stories about how I've used some of this good friction as part of making this practice my own. And in particular, in relation to the Buddha. When I first started practicing, I didn't actually pay much attention to the Buddha, which maybe sounds a bit strange, but I found it difficult to relate to him sitting up there on the altar. He didn't really feel particularly relevant to me or my life, and plus there was all of the other stuff to try to navigate. So it seemed very easy just to push aside, who is the Buddha? But after some time of practicing, you know, I set up a home altar with a Buddha and a candle and some flowers and a water offering like we do here. And I really wanted to love my Buddha. But how? How could I authentically relate to him? And I knew how we do it here, but it felt a little like supposed to, you know, which didn't feel particularly natural or genuine. So, but I longed for a relationship to the Buddha. I just didn't know how to make it happen. And it's not something you can fake. I tried that too. So I remember being in one of the week-long retreats at the monastery called Sishin, and realizing that I never looked directly at the Buddha. I would always avert my eyes, even with my home altar, kind of not look. And when I thought about it, I also thought like, oh, I avert my eyes because in some way I don't think he's really there for me, you know? And as certainly I tend to do, maybe you too, I sort of assumed everybody else was having this incredible relationship with the Buddha, and I was sort of the only one, like, not for me, you know? And, you know, I just want to pause also here and just say, like, yes, there's all the externals which are easily to get caught up in, and it's easy to just miss that. But, you know, a very wise friend said to me, we bring our mind to everything we do. So, of course, this feeling like, oh, I wish, but not for me, didn't just happen here in the Zendo. It was kind of everywhere in my life. And it certainly had its own causes and conditions, which are, you know, I come by it honestly. I'm not a bad person or whatever. It's just like, yeah, this is what has come for me in this life. So it's not a stretch to see that I would struggle to think that I even deserved to have a relationship with the Buddha. So back to Sishin. Once that sort of awareness came up and I was like, wow, I've never looked directly at the Buddha, I decided to go up the hill. If you've been to the monastery, it's beautiful, and there's a wooded hillside, and in the top there's the cemetery, which is one of my favorite places in the whole place. So I thought, during rest period after lunch, I'm going to walk up the hill and I'm going to go to the open-air chapel that's there. And there's a big stone Buddha there. And there's benches that you can sit on right in front. And I thought, I'm going to sit there and I am going to look him in the eyes, whether he wants me to or not. I'm going to do it. So like I got up there and like I did. And I have to say, it took some courage. It took some courage to like, okay, who are you? And who are you to me? But it was a real turning point for me in my practice. And it started a conversation with the Buddha that's ongoing, ever evolving. And I still make a point of looking him right in the eyes every time I approach the altar. So I want to encourage you, you know, whether you're here for the first time or the thousandth time, you know, where are you feeling those, well, not me, or that resistance? You know, I think there's some really good information there. That's that good friction, right? It's an invitation to look a little closer, maybe peel back a layer of that narrative, what's really happening? Yeah, and as I say, it's ongoing. So I want to sort of fast forward. That happened many years ago now, and recall a time more recently, early 2024, when I attended an online series on the sacred feminism, sacred feminine in Buddhism. And I know a couple other people here also attended that series. It was led by Amy Kisei Kostenbader Sensei. She's a teacher in sort of our Dharma cousins, Great Vow, out in Oregon. She received her transmission, her permission to teach from Chosen Bay Roshi, who's sort of our Dharma auntie or grandmother, I'm not sure. So each week we would gather on Zoom and she would offer a theme and that sort of was an exploration of like, how does the feminine appear in Buddhism? And one of the themes was grief and the various ways that it played a role in some of the most influential women ancestors' entry into Buddhist practice. And as we talked in the class, I started wondering like, you know, portraying these women's grief as a turning point in their spiritual path, it started to feel quite gendered in its practice. Like, when was grief ever mentioned in any of the male ancestors as an entry point? Did it ever become a pivot point for them as it did for these women? And reflecting on that got me thinking about the story about Siddhartha, who is that is the name of the Buddha before he was the Buddha. And there's a very famous story of his home leaving. And it's usually described very kind of heroically, where he sneaks out of his house at the middle of the night under the cover of darkness, leaving behind a wife and a newborn son in his sort of quest for putting an end to suffering. And there's never any mention that he felt any grief about doing that. Did he? Did he have sadness? You know, for me, one of the most important aspects of Buddhism is the Buddha was a real person, not a deity. He was born, he lived, and he died. He's a person like you and like me. That feels very important. So whoever told this story in this particular way had an agenda. And I've seen people, mostly women, raise this question. Really? He just left? You know? How can that be skillful? And usually I've also seen them kind of be shamed. It's like, really? You're caught in your emotions when you talk about it that way. But I find that to be quite harmful, actually. And I see it sort of playing out in subtle ways even today in our own practice. And, you know, I wonder if it doesn't perpetuate and encourage everyone to question just normal human feelings of grief and confusion, especially as we take up a practice that, you know, sometimes is asking us to reshape our life to be in accord with the Dharma, the teachings. So I wondered if I acknowledged the fullness of Siddhartha's humanity at that crucial point in his life, what would it look like? So in her book, The Woman Who Raised the Buddha, Wendy Garland says that we should use our intuition, our imagination, and our common sense to fill out the gaps in our inherited Buddhist history to make it more inclusive. And in particular, she's talking about women who, by and large, have been erased from Buddhist history. You know, we're starting to bring them back. So taking this encouragement to heart, I decided to write a new version of Siddhartha's home leaving that leaves room for his heroism. I mean, it was brave. It took courage, but also his grief. And I wanted to bring Yashodhara, who's his wife, into the story in a new way, where she's less of a victim and more of a critical player in both of their stories. And it was quite a fascinating experiment to try to inhabit Siddhartha's mind at that particular moment, you know. And it has definitely changed my relationship to the Buddha, and it's made him more real and human. And who knows, maybe it's the true story. But it's also, it's my story that I invented with my own agenda. So just to be clear. And, you know, I want to just also give a shout out to Hojin Sensei at this point, because, like, I'm not a creative story writer. I write in my work, but, like, not in that way. So I really didn't know how to begin. I had this idea. It kind of cooked for a while in my mind, but I was really kind of stymied. Like, how do you even write a story like that? And then I was in one of Hojin's Friday morning, our online art sessions, which I highly recommend. If you can anyway configure your life to attend, please attend. And I just thought, you know what? It's just like making a drawing. You have to make a mark first, you know, just get rid of that white page. So I thought, I'll just write a sentence and see what happens. And what happened was, once I started writing, I couldn't stop. Like, it just poured out of me, almost as if it had been waiting to happen. And I actually kind of, like, blew off my work for, like, 2 days while I was just like, and then, you know. But it was just coming through, and it was coming through in a way that felt true. Not like, this is me making it up. It was just like, oh, yeah, of course, of course. So I want to read a little bit, a very abridged version of this story that I wrote. Just so you can get a flavor. But really my purpose is to really encourage also for you to take up this use of your imagination, your intuition, and your common sense. Don't leave that part out. To wonder about the received stories as a way of deepening your relationship to the Buddha, to the practice. We can wonder, we can be curious. It's okay. So the story is called Siddhartha Leaves Home. Siddhartha sits on his bed with his head in his hands, his chest tight, his tears brimming in his eyes. This thing, this nagging, terrible thing has been haunting him like a demon. One minute, he's playing with his newborn son, delighting in his chubby cheeks and belly, and the next, this thing descends like a chill, a dread, a knowing, and it only gets louder the more he tries to push it to the back of his mind. Don't ignore me, this specter whispers in his ear. Even the sweet gurgles of his beloved Rahula can't drown it out. It isn't hard to pinpoint when it began. 2 days ago, he did the very thing he had been warned against for his whole life. He ventured out beyond the walls of the family compound. Before then, he had occasionally wondered what was beyond the walls, but life was so good and every need quickly fulfilled that any glimmer of wonder disappeared like smoke up a chimney. And if curiosity lingered in him, it wasn't long before he was called to a meal or a lesson, or as an adult, a meeting or other work, and it was gone. Plus, to go outside would mean to go against the wishes of his parents and teachers. And whatever they said, he took as law. He never questioned this. Why would he? Now, as he sits on his bed wiping his eyes, he wonders if perhaps his parents and teachers anticipated this moment. There are no shortages of prophecies about him. He's well aware of that. When he was younger, he disliked the whispers, the stares, the way people would go silent when he entered the room. He pretended to know their talk wasn't about him, but there had been so much talk about him and about his mother and his aunt. It was so tiresome. All he wanted was to live without all that talk swirling around him. And yet, as he thought as he sat on his bed, tears running down his cheeks, living his life, was precisely what was causing this pain. It's nighttime, and the household is quiet. Siddhartha can hear the steady rhythm of Yashodhara's breathing as she sleeps beside him. Her sleep is so peaceful and trusting, well-earned after a busy day of caring for their son and managing the household. Ice-cold dread rises from the pit of Siddhartha's stomach. Her innocence is only a further indictment of the horror of this creeping sensation. He clenches his jaw. It's wrong. What kind of man would, he can't even say it. Can't even allow himself to think it. He lies on his back with his eyes open in the darkness, forcing himself to go over the coming day's plans. The predictability of his usual responsibilities soon has his eyelids drooping, and he welcomes sleep at last. Then I kind of go on and talk about his encounter outside the walls of his home, where he, for the first time, encounters old age, illness, and death. Now 3 days have passed since the fateful carriage ride, and he has not had a moment's peace trying to understand what he saw. All his education in the Vedas feels empty. As he watches the Brahmins doing their morning rituals around the palace, questions start taking shape in his mind. What about that old woman on the street? Or that man with no nose facing a painful, certain death? What about the merchant's body going up in flames on the funeral pyre? How are these rituals addressing any of that suffering? What good of it is any of it in the face of all that pain? He recalled his favorite teacher telling him that all mental activities could be either tormenting or not tormenting. And he remembered laughing when that came up in his lessons as a young man. He never had any thought torment him. They were like flies that he could easily swat away. But now he understood. This particular fly had become a tormenting monster, and it was trying to drive him out the door into something truly unknown. Siddhartha lies in bed next to Yashodhara, again in the dark. It's hot and sticky, and they're both restless. Wide awake, the tormenting thoughts take over once again. Siddhartha has been raised to be a king, a leader, a warrior. Is he brave enough to face this monster? Does he have the courage to leave everything beloved to him behind in search of answers? Wouldn't that mean allowing the monster to chase him out in fear? As soon as he has that thought, he knows it's wrong. The specter whispering, you must, is not a monster at all. In fact, it's his own clarity. A new version of this specter rises in his mind. This one is not tormenting and dark. It's clear. It's bright and penetrating. He knows exactly what he needs to do. He knows. And in this knowledge, he bursts out crying. My love, what's happening? Why are you awake? Why are you crying? Yashodhara rolls onto one side and props herself up on one elbow to face her husband. She's concerned, but also relieved that whatever had been going on with her husband will finally be revealed. For 3 days, she's watched him moping around, by turns irritable and short-tempered, then lethargic and listless. She looks at his face now contorted with sadness, and dread rises in her stomach. She has her own sense about what's coming. Even as he curses the ride he took outside the palace for upending all he believed, Siddhartha knows it was a turning point in his life. His heart breaks as he begins to accept that he will no longer experience the comfort of Yashodhara's embraces, her kind words, her loving gestures. It splits open even further with the realization that he won't be there for his son, to see him walk, learn to talk, guide him as he too grows up to be a leader. How can leaving home ever not be a betrayal of everyone and everything that he holds dear? But he must. He must. Siddhartha searches Yashodhara's eyes for blame and anger after sharing his plans to leave home to seek answers to his burning questions, but he does not see that there. Like him, she understands that her role as his wife and Rahula's mother isn't meant to include her feelings, and she also feels confident they'll be well cared for in his absence. Still, her heart is also broken. Even so, she finds peace in the knowledge that Siddhartha is doing exactly what he's supposed to do. Peace and heartbreak, both are true. As word spreads that he'll be leaving, other women in the palace try to get Yashodhara to express her anger and resentment. They badmouth Siddhartha, saying he's only concerned about himself. Ironically, their criticism helps her see how his home leaving is in fact the opposite of selfish. Yes, there is heartbreak, but she finds only love at the center of her husband's actions. To both of their surprise, they discover their love can hold the grief of parting because it's so much larger than either of them. This is very hard to explain to those around them. But even this misunderstanding seems to be a part of it, accepting that others will never really understand that what seems like a sacrifice is actually a blessing on a whole other scale. Dawn light peeks over the walls of the family compound as Siddhartha gathers his bundle, while Yashodhara sits silently on the bed watching him. He's had his morning bath, knowing that it might be his last for a while. Despite his protest, Yashodhara tucks some food into his pack. It pains her to imagine him, tired and dusty, seeking food and kindness among strangers. If she can stave that off, even for a day, she will. Although Siddhartha's hands are steady as he ties his pack, his mind is agitated. What if I'm wrong? What if this is a huge mistake? He lets these thoughts wash over him and recede. Deep in his body, he knows that while he may make many mistakes on this new path, taking the path is not one of them. He looks into Yashodhara's eyes and receives her loving gaze, a gaze that he will recall many times in the coming days, weeks, and months. The power of her love and inner strength, giving him strength to keep on going. Siddhartha stands in the doorway, the courtyard's taken shape in the early morning light, and steps outside. Yashodhara watches his retreating figure and then turns back to her work as he disappears among the trees. If no one else understands, it doesn't matter. They know. They know.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/zcnyc.